It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, from pension debt to rainy day funds, we'll find out how Wisconsin stacks up in a national study of financial well-being.
First, officials from Milwaukee and beyond, including State Attorney General Brad Schimmel, came together for a press conference yesterday to announce a new coordinated strategy to combat gun violence in the city, one that's all-encompassing and includes everyone from police officers to federal prosecutors.
The announcement comes at a particularly striking time for Milwaukee. The city's homicide count now stands at 86 for the year. That matches the total number of homicides the city saw in all of 2014.
WPR's Gilman Halstead joins us now with more. Gil, welcome back.
Thanks.
Well, this is being billed as a coordinated effort to reduce gun violence in the city of Milwaukee, and it doesn't just include Milwaukee officials. Who's on board with this effort?
Well, it is actually mostly Milwaukee officials, but other than the mayor, the police chief, and the district attorney's office, and the police department, as well as the district attorney, all assistant district attorneys are on this as well. It includes the Department of Justice, the Attorney General's Office, Brad Schimmel, and federal prosecutors have agreed to assist when they're called on from the U.S. Attorney's Office, but they actually didn't sign this memorandum of understanding that came out of yesterday's news conference. That included the ones that I listed before. And so they have all agreed to commit resources and time to focus on getting violent criminals who commit crimes with guns off the street as quickly and efficiently as possible. And so, I forgot to mention the Department of Corrections. The Community Corrections Office, probation and parole agents are also going to be a big part of this.
And as far as you know, how does the plan taking shape? What is it going to look like?
Well, the Department of Justice is going to give $50,000 in federal funds that they're going to free up for the Milwaukee Police Department for overtime expenses. But the Attorney General's office is also going to be deputing two assistant attorney generals who will work specifically with the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office to handle firearms-related investigations and prosecutions, including cases involving unlawful possession of firearms and non-fatal shootings. So we were talking about how there have been so many gun homicides this year. There's also been a big spurt in non-fatal gun injuries going on. So it's going to cover everything that has to do with guns. So they'll have those people. The Department of Corrections has agreed to basically tell their parole and probation officers to take part in targeting high-risk offenders likely to be involved in firearm-related violence. They're going to be sharing data from their network. And when I talked to Attorney General Brad Schimmel last night, he said that means they're going to be stepping up the number of residence calls they do on high-risk offenders who are out on parole or probation, you know, who committed violent crimes before, perhaps with a gun. They're going to be knocking on their door more. They're going to be checking bars to see if they're out at the bars. And they're going to be basically looking for them to whether they've broken any rules so they can revoke their probation. And as the Attorney General told me, get them back in prison before they kill somebody.
And that sounds like an effort coming from what Attorney General Schimmel has said, that more than half of the shootings in the city are committed by people on parole or probation. So it sounds like that person power added is intended explicitly to address that issue.
Exactly. And they may be stepping up the use of GPS monitoring on identifying high-risk offenders for some enhanced supervision. They're already doing that, but they'll be paying more attention to putting those bracelets on people who they think really are at risk of committing more crimes with guns.
Now, there seems to be a focus on prosecution here instead of prevention. Why prosecution, do you know?
Well, it's to get people off the streets. I mean, they want new sentences for these people to discourage them from thinking that they can use guns to commit crimes. And the prevention front, it's sort of included in the Memorandum of Understanding on the side of the mayor's, the role that Mayor Tom Barrett is going to play, because they're going to be working with neighborhood associations as well. And that will involve what they call call-ins, I believe, at some time, where they're going to be calling in people that they suspect may be involved in crimes that use guns or selling guns, and they're basically going to summon them to come to a community meeting and confront them with the fact that they are beginning to gather evidence about them and say, you better get straight or we're going to send you to jail. So those are, we're going to pursue this investigation and put you in jail. So I think that you're right. The emphasis definitely is on getting people off the street and also on solving the crimes that have been committed. This is following prosecutions all the way from the beginning of the investigation to the end, so they make sure that they are actually getting the person off the street who committed a murder or a gun crime.
We're talking to WPR's Gilman Halstead right now about a new initiative in the city of Milwaukee to reduce gun violence. And Gilman, this has a bit of a history here, going back to Attorney General Brad Schimel's election. What has he said about this effort?
Well, he said during the campaign that this was going to be one of his priorities, that reducing the amount of gun crime in Milwaukee was something that he was going to focus on. And he said very explicitly that he thought that the Milwaukee District Attorney and the police department needed the help of the state to deal with the amount of violence that was going on. And so this is, in a sense, for Schimel, following through on a campaign promise. When he made it, there was sort of some pushback from the district attorney's office, from John Chisholm's office, and from some other DAs around the state that said they were concerned about the State Department of Justice interfering with what they were doing or criticizing them for not actually doing their jobs of bringing prosecutions to a conviction in enough cases. In fact, there were a list of statistics during the campaign that Schimel put out showing that there were a lot of people who were being charged and then they ended up not being convicted in crimes that involved guns.
Now, another part of this initiative that we haven't touched on yet is the creation of a new gun court. How would that work?
Well, you know, it's not in the memorandum of agreement and or understanding, but when I talked to Attorney General Brad Schimel last night, he said that the chief judges there are signed on to this coordinated initiative as well, and what they're going to do is create a new gun court, which is sort of like the drug courts and other treatment courts we have, except that they're focused on convicting people and sending them to prison rather than keeping them out. But it's a court where gun crimes are going to be prosecuted. And right now, the problem, according to Attorney General Schimel, is that a defendant who's been charged with a gun crime can ask for a substitution when they're sent into the gun court. And that means they get shifted to another judge who may not be focusing on this issue as much. And in this way, if they have two judges who are designated as gun court judges, even if a defendant asks for a substitution, he's still going to be in a gun court. And so the focus will be part of this intense, get a speedy trial, get someone convicted, and get that person who's been committing violence with a gun off the street.
Now, there's been some frustration expressed this year about the legislature's stance on gun laws, and some city officials in Milwaukee have been calling for tougher restrictions. Is that still a part of the picture, something that's still being talked about?
Actually, don't think it's being talked about. I'm sure it didn't come up at the news conference yesterday, because I think everyone really wanted to be on the same page and agree that the focus was going to be on getting criminals with guns and not on imposing new laws on the sale and possession of guns. So it's still out there, but with the current legislative majority that we have right now, I don't think that there's going to be a move in the direction of the people like Mayor Tom Barrett and even Police Chief Ed Flynn and John Chisholm might like to see, which would be to push for a complete background checks kind of law to prevent the number of guns being sold to criminals privately, which are not regulated right now.
Gil, thanks for joining us. That was WPR's Gilman Halstead joining us to talk about a new initiative to combat gun violence in Milwaukee. the new report examines the fiscal well-being of all 50 states, figuring out whether state governments can pay what they owe in the short run and the long run. Big picture, Wisconsin is in the middle of the pack at 28th best in the nation, but behind that number is some good news and bad news.
Report author Eileen Norcross joins us now. She's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Eileen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what were you trying to capture in this new report?
This new report looks at the comprehensive annual financial reports that all 50 states produce to look at their finances, and I was trying to measure how the states did on a short-term basis, whether they could cover bills in the short run, in the medium term, and also in the long run, how large are their debts.
And we can get into some of the comparisons in a moment, but by and large, are states doing well or poorly?
I would say it depends. We have some states that do well in the rankings, but that's largely due to the fact that they have a very low level of debt and they happen to have a good budget, a good year, a fiscal year for 2013 in terms of cash. And then some states, the states that are doing poorly in the ranking are those that have been amassing long-term liabilities that are underfunded over a long period of time. Most states are probably in the middle of the pack.
Well, let's get into some of the particulars here in Wisconsin. And this is all from before our latest budget round, so an asterisk on some of the questions here. But one of our bright spots in your report looks to be the state's ability to meet pension debts. What's the story there?
Wisconsin probably has one of the best funded pension systems in the nation, although I went in and recalculated that unfunded liability. In Wisconsin, the way it's calculated there, it's about entirely funded, 100% funded, relatively small liability. When I recalculated it on a guaranteed to be paid basis, I do find there's a bigger shortfall of $30 billion, and it's 74% funded, which is still among the best in the nation. So they have a very good record of making that annual contribution and stewarding the fund.
And this is an issue you've been looking at, not just in this report, but elsewhere. And a lot of states and local governments have had serious problems with pension liabilities. Is there something Wisconsin has done right that other governmental agencies could be learning from?
Well, I think it's the discipline. I think it's making that annual contribution and taking that fiduciary responsibility seriously. States that are doing poorly in that regard are states that elected to skip on contributions, to bond those contributions, and that added more debt. So some of those states are now paying the price for that, and that they have huge unfunded liabilities.
In that sense, then, Wisconsin is more or less paying now for what it owes in the future. The cities we see in trouble, states we see in trouble, are saying, eh, we'll figure this out later, in effect.
They've had that, unfortunately, they've done that for a period of years, skipping over those contributions, let's say in a tight budgetary year or when the market's not doing well, whereas Wisconsin seems to have had just much better discipline in making those full annual contributions.
Now, a place we're ranked lower here in Wisconsin, a category called a cash solvency. That sounds like, I think that's a short-term rating. We're ranked 41st. What is that? Why are we ranked relatively low there?
Cash measures how much liquid cash the state has on hand to cover short-term bills, how much short-term assets they have. And what that's looking at is how much do you have set aside, how much is available should there be a downturn. Here, Wisconsin does poorly in the cash ratio. They have less cash on hand to cover short-term bills by the most conservative metric, and a little bit under the benchmark is usually 2. You should have twice the cash on hand to cover short-term bills. They're a little bit under that. It could be a reflection of the recession. I did go back and read Wisconsin's report, and they're replenishing the rainy day fund now, which is good. This could still be a residual from the recession.
Well, rainy day fund is a phrase I wanted to throw at you. This is something that for at least 2 decades, probably longer, Wisconsin politicians have been saying, we need a bigger rainy day fund. We don't have enough of one. We'll ask Eileen Norcross about that in a minute. Just to refresh, we are talking to Eileen Norcross from the Mercatus Center. She looked at all 50 states, compared how they're doing and their fiscal outlook. Short-term and long-term, can states pay what they need to pay? Are things like pension mandates funded? Wisconsin fared very well on that. To some other categories, including some we'll get into, not as well. Coming up in just a bit, we'll be talking about a related issue, really financial literacy, but at a personal level, we'll hear from a lawmaker who says we need in our schools to be teaching financial literacy to all of our students at some point or another. This is something that happens in some schools around the state, doesn't happen in others. Our next guest coming up after the half hour says it should be happening in all schools. So Eileen Norcross, rainy day funds, I was saying Wisconsin has been saying for a long time, politicians have been saying we haven't put enough into rainy day funds. Is this something that you think other states that rate better in this category have made more of a priority of?
A few states are doing a good job of rainy day funds. One of them is West Virginia. They have been very disciplined about that, and I think that is something they can be proud of. More states should be doing that. States that elect to keep those really underfunded are running into a bad situation when a recession hits. So I'd like to see improvement across the board in the states there. It's good to see Wisconsin's among those that's making that a priority, at least in their CAF, where they indicate it is.
And at budget time, does it often happen that, hey, we've got a tight budget, rainy day funding would be lovely, but we're going to put something else as our priority and forget about that for another year, 2 years, 5 years?
Sometimes. It depends on the design of the rainy day fund. It depends on the rules. Some states have a really strict requirement that they're going to put something in that fund according to a rule. When it gets to this threshold, we have to contribute. Others, it's a little more ad hoc. So that's how, across the states, it just varies in practice how they're used and when they can dip into them. What are the rules around that rainy day fund?
Now, long-run solvency is another category you rated for states, and this is another one where Wisconsin comes in pretty low, 38th among the states. What goes into that?
That looks at the assets to liabilities. The net asset ratio is looking at whether the state might be using debt finance to pay for current spending. Here you have a negative net asset ratio, although it's not that negative. It's a negative 8%. That indicates that there may be issuing debt there to cover bills, which, you know, it should be evaluated in context, not necessarily an alarm. The long-term liability ratio measures liabilities to assets, and in Wisconsin, liabilities are 38% of total assets. That's a little bit lower than the national average, and long-term liability per capita is about average with the nation. So here, on a relative basis, they're about average with most of the states.
Now, as you say, that's not necessarily dangerous, but we hear accusations from usually the party not in power at any given time that taking on too much debt is kicking the can down the road, solving a problem today that's going to come back and bite us tomorrow. Have we seen other states run into problems when they went too far in that direction?
Absolutely. The states at the bottom of the ranking, Illinois, New Jersey, you've got Connecticut. These are states where they issued a lot of debt over the years to pay for ongoing spending. And then, let's say, bonding that pension contribution, their OPEB, which are those other post-employment benefits, are large and growing. So they're having to dip into this kind of funding, this debt funding to pay for these things. When you issue debt on top of debt, that then becomes a bigger problem. And those states are suffering from these much weaker long-term metrics.
So what happens in states facing that situation? Is that a case where, as we hear with cities, certainly where they're reevaluating what kind of pension benefits, health benefits former employees are getting?
I think it depends. I mean, what they have to evaluate is, you know, what did we legally guarantee to our employees, and how are we going to fund this and continue funding the current budget? This is something that I think Illinois and New Jersey are struggling with in particular, and you're finding even there they're just not able to keep up. They're not able to keep up with that yearly pension contribution. So I don't know what the answer is there, other than they're going to have to figure out different priorities, or they can either raise taxes, cut spending, figure out some kind of strategy.
And then another category we haven't talked about yet that you rated in this report is the ability for states, when they set a budget saying, hey, we're going to pay for this, that they can actually pay for it. How are we looking in Wisconsin on that?
In terms of the operating ratio, pretty good. It's average. You've got revenues exceeding expenses by 7% in 2013, so a little bit of a buffer, and a surplus of $419 per capita. So they had a good year in that revenues were slightly higher than expenses, a healthy operating ratio.
And this seems like one that could really change from moment to moment. Like if you suddenly had, say, a great recession happen in the middle of a year, revenue, say, sales tax revenue could drop. This is one that seems like it could be really subject to change over the course of a year or 2 years.
That's right. Those short-term metrics are subject to change, and I think they kind of give you a little bit of an immediate warning, a flag that, given economic conditions, we may not be able to meet the budget. The cash ratio is telling you, hey, we have to look at, are we building up that rainy day fund, or do we get into these situations when there's a recession? What is our cash position? So that definitely can be affected by the economy and by revenues.
Now, I know this all varies from state to state, but you've been looking at this as a huge mass of data. As somebody who researches how states work, how their budgets work, do you feel nervous? Are we headed toward problems in a lot of states in this country, or by and large, are we thinking ahead, doing what we need to do?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think that, again, some states seem to be more forward-thinking than others in terms of keeping that the cash position pretty healthy and also managing those debts. And those are some of the states at the top. And then towards the bottom, you've got, again, the states that were hurt by the recession, have not recovered, or are recovering in a very weak sense. And then you've got those pressing long-term liabilities. In the middle, it really does vary from state to state. Some states seem to be doing better managing that short-term position and looking out towards the long-term. But I'd say most states have got to do a better job of paying attention to those long-term liabilities and making sure that if you get a windfall, like a North Dakota, that you're using some of that to take care of the long-term debts and not just thinking about today.
Eileen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Eileen Norcross, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, talking about her new report on the fiscal well-being of states around the country. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. For kids in Wisconsin, money management is something they may or may not learn in school. Now, one state lawmaker is looking to standardize that, and he's introducing a bill that would make financial literacy education mandatory in Wisconsin schools.
It's an idea that's gotten support over the years, but some critics worry that a mandate would take away local control from school districts. We want to hear what you think about the idea of financial literacy education in the schools. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Scott Krug. He's a Republican state representative from Nakusa. Representative Krug, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
So why are you looking to add financial literacy education as a mandatory part of Wisconsin schools?
Well, started looking at this issue a couple of years back. I've been working in some of these arenas with Money Smart Week through some of the financial groups in Wisconsin. We started talking about the level of financial literacy that kids have when they graduate high school or college, and it just seemed to be no good requirement for students to have to have that knowledge and experience while they're in school. So we started looking at what Wisconsin had available, and back in 2006, the DPI had a very collaborative process where they came up with some model academic standards for personal financial literacy. So we're taking a look at trying to figure out how to incorporate those standards that were worked on together collaboratively with all the stakeholders, including educators and financial groups, et cetera, and bringing them into the K-12 system, because I think it's absolutely critical that every student who either graduates high school or college in the state of Wisconsin has a basic understanding of how finances affect their lives going forward.
Now, some schools in the state already incorporate financial literacy into their current curriculum, usually as part of an existing class. Why do you think it needs to be a standalone subject, one that in your plan includes testing too?
Well, I think, you know, as we go through the process, we've talked with school boards and other stakeholder groups about the testing component that's likely to come out. It's one of the things that we think we can still achieve our goals without standardizing the test for it. But back to the main question is, a lot of schools in Wisconsin do offer some form of personal financial literacy in K-12 education. The vast majority are in the upper levels, you know, the 9, 10, 11, 12th grade. We're looking to bring it across the curriculum throughout courses, whether it's a history class or a math class or, you know, any other classes that can incorporate what the standards actually say. Now, the standards themselves aren't necessarily just one class. They are incorporated in so many different levels throughout the everyday curriculum that I think it's something that we can fit into the existing school day without putting too much pressure on existing electives and other courses that are out there, since it's incorporated into other courses along the way.
Now, why not let schools choose their curriculum and have that sort of local control that has been talked about a lot among the Republican legislature instead of adding a mandate?
Well, I'm not against saying that we can find other ways to get this incorporated into the classroom. I think in the end, 74% of our schools already offer this in one level or another, as you mentioned. If it had been 5 or 10% of our schools that offer it, then taking that step to 100% would be a step way too far. I think we're to the point where every school district recognizes the importance of this. So whether some call it a mandate or some call it whatever you want to say about it, the vast majority of school districts already do have something in the works. DPI already has a set standard. DPI already has curriculum planning tools available. We're not asking anybody to recreate the wheel here. We're just asking to incorporate some new concepts. And it's only a step. And I think when we mentioned this at the public hearing last week, we said we want this to be in place for every student K through 12 and for orientation for Tech and UW students who may not get it in high school because they graduate. And we've said that if there are other mandates that we can look at doing away with or making it easier to fit into the regular school day or the school week or the school hour, we're more than flexible to look at these things. But I think the idea that all the school districts who already have this in place understand there's a need for it tells me that we can take these steps without hurting their already existing curriculums.
Now, what kind of concepts? You mentioned new concepts. What would you like to see taught in these financial literacy classes?
You know, the exciting things that I mentioned, you know, when we had our public hearing were the facts that, you know, fourth graders can start understanding the effects of career choices into future potential earning opportunities. Eighth graders could learn about how to determine something on an opportunity cost level, where they can weigh the risk and reward based on the financial opportunity costs. High schoolers will be learning how to make basic investments and how to watch out for, you know, predatory credit card companies or payday lenders or things like that. Because what we see on a big level is high schoolers and college graduates coming out of their academic institutions already being pegged by somebody who is, you know, preyed upon their credit score or preyed upon their decision making because they have a lack of understanding in some issues. So the credit ratings are maybe lower, or their earning potentials may be lower, or they can't afford to buy a car, or they can't afford to buy a house. Those are things that are absolutely critical components to a basic education, I think, here in Wisconsin and nationwide, that students understand that the choices they make now are greatly going to affect their future, and even more so in a day where there's so many more financial agencies and tools and things out there that never existed before. So it's something we have to start addressing early on.
State Representative Scott Krug is with us now talking about his proposal to make financial literacy education mandatory in Wisconsin schools. And you talked about the importance of getting at these concepts, having literacy about finances early on. Why early on?
Well, I think, you know, like I had mentioned, is that by the time we're talking high school and college graduates, it may be too late to, you know, stop a bad choice from happening from the time of students 17, 18, 19, 20, where somebody's got a hold of them saying, hey, fill up this credit card application, we'll give you a free T-shirt, and that may look exciting. But without understanding the concepts of an annual percentage rate and all these things that go into these bad credit card deals, it's going to affect their future significantly if they fall into a spiral of debt. So preventing that spiral of debt from occurring really helps us build on our economy in the state of Wisconsin because we have good consumers who make good educated choices on financial products. So I think the earlier that we introduce them to concepts relating to money, it'll translate better into future success for personal savings and growth into their adulthood.
Now, you've got an education system right now, a public education system, where classroom time is at a premium. You've got literacy that needs to be worked on with kids, math skills, the sciences, technology. Is there really time to add another mandate for financial literacy when there's so much other important stuff that's on the table and there seems not to be enough time for it right now?
And, you know, some school districts may have legitimate complaints in that area, and we're open to trying to find ways to make it easier to adapt something into their curriculums. It may not end up being the statewide standards that were created in 2006. It may get to the point where in the bill we say, you can choose your standard, create your own curriculum, but we need to make sure that these concepts are at least covered at some portion through your social studies or your math or through your English. And as we talk about financial literacy concepts, the concept of money really translates well into elementary math. And it really helps students learn better how to deal with fractions and decimals as well. So I think incorporating those all at the same time really has more payoff than just the financial literacy skills in the end. I think it has a better payoff for, you know, academic learning potential overall.
Let's go to our callers now. We have Dan with us first in La Crosse. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Representative Krug, if anybody needs a lesson in financial literacy, I think it's the Republican Party in the state of Wisconsin and our governor. You guys just went and are going to borrow $800 million for the transportation fund because you can't fund it right now. Yet they go and raise the speed limit to 70 miles an hour.
Dan, I'm going to jump in on you, Dan, because I want to keep focused on the idea here. What do you think about the idea of financial literacy?
I think this is another act of micromanaging. I taught my kids financial literacy at home. If Representative Klug is so worried about this, why don't you talk to the parents? Because all you're doing is burdening the teachers with more. I have a sister that's a teacher, and believe me, their hands are full.
All right, Dan, thank you. Appreciate your comment there. Dan saying teachers' hands are full. We were talking about that a little bit more about classroom time. And saying talk to the parents. Have you done that? Have you reached out to the parents to see what they say?
Well, absolutely. And these are bills that we don't just create in a vacuum. These are bills that we hear from educators, from parents, from those involved in the everyday process of education that can tell us, hey, this is something that we, you know, can offer, but it's something that, you know, we could use some more help with. And when it comes back to trying to figure out how to incorporate it into everyday curriculum for every school district, we can give them those flexibilities to decide how exactly they're going to adapt it, how exactly to fit the, you know, new concepts into whatever class that it is. And, it, you know, in the kindergarten through sixth grade level, it's probably, you know, a few minutes a week. We're not talking that we have to dedicate, you know, an hour a week to prefer, you know, per financial literacy in, you know, elementary grades. It's something that we can have conversations on how to fit it in to make sure that the concepts make sense and that the school districts can apply them. So I think, you know, when folks say this is a, you know, we're adding other classes and we're adding other mandates, we're asking for more concepts to be introduced from time to time throughout an elementary system. And for the existing courses that already exist in the 74% of our school districts, they're already going to reach the effect of what we're talking about in this bill already.
All right, let's go to one more caller here. Paul joins us in West Bend. Paul, hi.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon. I think it's compelling to just be mandatory. I mean, it could be integrated into the other subject matters. I mean, when they graduate out of high school, they should know what a C corporation is, an S corporation, a sole proprietorship. They should be able to analyze a simple contract. It's pathetic, the level of ignorance in financial knowledge. I mean, it's compelling. It's necessary for if you've got an entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, financial knowledge, and if you're going to start a new business or if you're going to start an enterprise and start some collaborative operations with other individuals or companies, it's compelling in the global economy. And I just think it's a great idea. And parents, many parents probably don't have much knowledge, so this next generation has to be enlightened.
All right. Well, thanks, Paul. Good points there. And I want to get at an interesting topic that Paul brought up there. Do you think this would encourage entrepreneurship with the education? Do you think get into the sorts of things he was talking about there?
You know, I think it's one thing that we know that it definitely will not hurt the idea of entrepreneurship in Wisconsin. We know that right now, we need to do a better job in the state of encouraging entrepreneurship and to give people more skills throughout K through 12 and the university and tech system in learning financial concepts so they can feel more comfortable becoming entrepreneurs. It is. It's a great side benefit of what we're trying to accomplish. I think we've seen the concept of the brain drain over the Midwest area and folks maybe graduating institutions in Wisconsin and leaving for Minnesota, Iowa, California, wherever it may be. If Wisconsin can take the lead in these concepts and encourage students that you don't need to go somewhere else to know how to achieve in life and how to plan for future academic and financial success, that we're going to give you the tools to do that, it can only help.
We're talking right now with State Representative Scott Krug about his proposal to make financial literacy education mandatory in Wisconsin schools. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234.
What do you think about this idea? Do you think kids at all levels need more financial literacy education? Have you taught financial literacy either as a teacher or as a parent? What works? What do kids need to know? How have you mixed it in with lessons on math, reading, science, that sort of thing? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Republican State Representative Scott Krug. He's behind a bill that would make some kind of financial literacy education mandatory in Wisconsin schools. What do you think about that idea? We're taking your questions, your comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go back to our callers now. We've got Linda with us in Madison. Hi, Linda.
Hi. One of the best and sometimes underutilized resources for financial information, from banking to shopping, to gardening, to home canning, you name it, is the county extension programs, part of the Wisconsin idea that seems to be under attack during this present administration. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Linda. And the county extension, what do you think about incorporating that somehow, Representative Krug?
Well, you know, I think county extension was one of the things that a lot of us rural Republican legislators fought to maintain funding for in the last state budget here that was just passed. I think we were pretty successful understanding the value that extension adds to all 72 counties across the state. And there may be a way for extension to be involved in some of these programs right now. They do a great job with some of the other programs for consumer economics and for, you know, agricultural economics in the state of Wisconsin. So, you know, we're more than happy to try to find a seat for them at the table.
Okay, appreciate the call, Linda. And we go next to Adam in New Berlin. Adam, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to say that I think it's a really good idea to add financial education to the curriculum because, you know, a lot of people are saying talk to the parents about it and get them involved in their kids' education, but that's assuming that all parents have an active role in finances and are really good at taking care of their money. You know, not all parents are really good at their own finances, so maybe that education needs to come from outside the home.
And I appreciate the call and the thoughts there. And Representative Krug, do you think that a policy like this, if it were effective, could help bridge the gap between the haves and the have-nots when it comes to financial education, and the people who have it might have a jump on those who don't?
Well, I think it's a great point. I know that, you know, there are many parents in my area that may not have the best understanding of some of these concepts and wish that they had had the opportunity to do so. We've even heard from a few state legislators who had said, you know, it would have been great to have these concepts introduced to them in high school and college instead of having to go through the, you know, hard knocks learning, you know, that goes along with financial literacy right now across most of the state. So I think there's a lot of added benefit into trying to make sure that those folks who are looking to employ in the state of Wisconsin or to create businesses here have a really good understanding of what they're looking towards and what the choices they make in 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade really do make and make an effect on their lives later on. You know, when it comes to understanding the concepts of a debit card and keeping track of the ledger and making sure that you know that what you've spent as opposed to what you're bringing in. I mean, just those are very basic concepts that sometimes we glean over, and some folks who may not have the ability to teach at home aren't able to add that to a child's education. We need to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to at least be exposed to it.
Have you checked out any other districts around the country and whether they incorporate something like this and whether it makes a difference?
Right, yeah. We had talked to a professor from Stanford University who did a study in conjunction with the Federal Reserve who basically said the same things we're talking about today, is that when you put that mandate in, at least at the high school level, the study was, so when the mandate's in place at the high school level, just the mere exposure to these concepts gives students a better advantage in the rest of their lives, understanding how to increase their earning potential and how to save for future purchases. Just some of those studies that are out there alone, and there's a growing body of evidence saying that just simple exposure to these concepts, whether it reaches everybody or not,
gives a better understanding to the groups that, you know, have the chance to at least learn what the concepts are. Whether they apply them or not, at least they're aware of them. And that's why we incorporated the tech and the UW orientation programs for freshmen, too. Because once this started and those graduating high school seniors move on to college, if they happen to do so before the law is implemented, at least at that point, then, they'll be exposed to these same concepts and have access to the same information that all the other students in Wisconsin would have access to, so they can still be made aware of what it takes to make a good choice for their financial future. And it's only going to improve our economy through those opportunity costs, educations to learn, you know, what's a good value in making a purchase, how do I, you know, go about saving to buy a car, how to not put everything under credit. And I think, you know, those concepts really will help those who are considered the have-nots in the learning process to become equalized and have a good base going into their future.
Now, is this something that you can see Democrats getting behind, having bipartisan support for?
We started this session talking with Representative Barnes from Milwaukee on trying to find things that we can compromise on to make a good bill even better. So Representative Barnes and I have pledged to continue to work together on this. Representative Polk, who is also on the Education Committee, gave a lot of great ideas at the public hearing last week. And when I testified at the public hearing on the bill, we took maybe three or four questions from committee members in total. And that tells me if it's a 5 or 10 minute questioning period, that as opposed to, you know, a half an hour of questions, that people understand that it's a good concept and that we can work together to find a way to make a good concept a realistic law that people, not only educators, but lawmakers and parents can all get behind and say, okay, we're moving the ball forward on kids' education in Wisconsin. So absolutely, we are going to work across the aisle and have some partners already.
Representative Krug, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
That was Scott Krug, Republican State Representative from Nakusa. He joined us to talk about his proposal to make financial literacy education mandatory in Wisconsin schools.
Planet Earth is stepping up the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, not just in X-Files, the revival currently in the works, but here in real life.
A Russian billionaire is kicking in $100 million to fund searches for signals of intelligence around the galaxy using some of the world's most powerful telescopes. It's called the Breakthrough Initiative, and it's gotten backing from serious scientists, including Stephen Hawking. Here he is at a press conference for that initiative.
There is no bigger question. It's time to commit to finding the answer to search for life beyond Earth.
So one of the interesting things about this, they're doing some crowdsourcing. They're going to take all these signals from telescopes. You can donate your computer time, your home computer, when you're not using it, obviously, and say, yeah, use my computer to try to track this data. They're going to create, in effect, the world's biggest computer with all of our personal computers.
My computer is so slow, it would dramatically slow down the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Put it back another 30 years or so.
Right.
Yeah.
It's an interesting initiative, though, and one that some people say should always be going on in the background at some level.
I guess we've been doing it on the cheap for a long time. The interesting thing is they're not trying to like look for a message from aliens. They're just trying to see, like when we're putting out signals, like radio signals, maybe they're doing that too, and we can detect. In fact, maybe us talking right now is the first thing the aliens are going to see about us.
We can only hope not.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure.
But it could be happening.
Greetings, alien dudes.
Wait, dudes and ladies.
And dudettes.